This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Gibbon. Toronto has gone crazy for the Raptors as that team plays in its first ever NBA Finals. You might expect things to be a bit calmer back in Oakland, where the Warriors have made the finals 5 years in a row. Not so at the house of Lloyd Cannamore. Lloyd lives in West Oakland. His 1,100-square-foot home is right next to an on-ramp for Interstate 580. You can't miss it, painted blue with gold trim, Golden State Warriors flags draped over the porch, and even a picture of Steph Curry framed in the window. KALW's Marco Seiler Gonzalez visited Lloyd at his home in Oakland.
Many folks in the Bay Area consider themselves Warriors fans, especially when the team is going for its third straight championship. But I'm going to tell you about someone who may be the Warriors' biggest fan.
Are you a Warrior fan?
Lloyd Cannamore is dressed head to toe in Warriors gear. And it's not just because I'm here to interview him. That's just what he wears. Plus, he's got two humongous championship rings on each hand.
Do you wear at least two at all times?
Yeah, all two at all times. But sometimes when I get fly, I put two more on, though.
The rings are replicas, by the way. Promotional giveaways handed out by the Warriors. If the world is the arena, Lloyd says his house is the locker room.
So look, I come outside. Here come the Warrior man. Warrior's my heart. I believe blue and gold. It's in me.
Let me tell you how Lloyd's connection to the team and the stadium goes deeper than most. When he was in high school in the late 70s, Lloyd took work as a snack vendor at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum Arena for Warriors home games.
Well, I'd be loud. Get your hot dogs here, hot dog, get your hot dogs here.
Lloyd often has a stutter, but it wasn't a problem when he was on the job.
Get your peanuts, hey, everybody, get your peanuts. Get your peanuts. I made money fast then.
Yeah.
Because I was strong and healthy.
He says the arena was another home. He practically felt like part of the team. Lloyd happily shows me an old photo of himself with Sonny Parker, a guard who was the Warriors' first-round pick in 1976.
I was just starting. I was 17 years old.
The years passed. Players came and went. But Lloyd stayed loyal. His friends even gave him a nickname.
The guy called me Hardaway. Was that Hardaway? Was that Hardaway?
Tim Hardaway was a point guard for the Warriors from the late 80s through the mid-90s.
Oh, Hardaway with the steal. Forget it here. And Tim goes in and slams it home.
As Lloyd's connection with the team grew deeper, his family life got more complicated. In 1997, his 14-year-old son, Lloyd Jr., died of cancer. A few months later, one of Lloyd's brothers died from AIDS. Just a few years ago, two of his remaining brothers died, one right after the other. A friend saw he was hurting and wanted to help, so he offered to paint Lloyd's house for free.
The man, how can you take two deaths back to back? He said, so I'll do you a favor. I'm going to paint your house. How you want it? I said, I want the Warrior colors.
Of course, Lloyd wanted his house painted blue and gold. Those colors are his emotional anchor in the wake of tragedy. And the bold paint job even turned out to reward him in a way he wouldn't have guessed. When rapper Bizzle wrote an unofficial team anthem called Warriors, he needed a location to shoot the video. And someone had the idea to make it outside the home of the number one Warriors fan, Lloyd. And guess who came by for the shoot? Superstar Stephen Curry. You can see him in the video, jumping alongside Lloyd.
We did 10 takes of that song. 10 takes of it. The same song, so at the end of the night, I couldn't raise my arm up.
Cause you were going crazy in that video.
Cause yeah, could be a winning.
Yeah.
Now that Lloyd's in his mid-50s, he doesn't go to games nearly as much as he used to. It's a full-time job taking care of his mother and five dogs, who all live in the Warriors' house. Plus, Lloyd is still dealing with personal hardship. His daughter Tamara is at Highland Hospital with a severe bacterial infection. Lloyd tells me that watching Warriors games calms his nerves, helps him through tough times, helps him survive his grief. His unrelenting fandom may appear to be a love for basketball, but it's also a mechanism to deal with a lifetime of trauma.
Just want to say a couple of words. It's very difficult to sum up how we feel about this building and all of our fans.
The Warriors are playing their last few games in Oakland. Next season, the team will move into its new $1.4 billion arena across the Bay. And to be honest, Lloyd hates San Francisco. Hates the Giants, not a fan of the 49ers. He says he'll just watch the Warriors games on TV.
Well, I hate going to San Francisco. It hurts me so bad because I'm not going to go not one time and go watch the game in Frisco.
Will it be the same, watching the Warriors from home? Maybe not. But that doesn't mean Lloyd Cannamore has any intention of painting his house any other colors than blue and gold.
That's reporter Marco Seiler Gonzalez. His story was originally produced for Bounce, a podcast from KALW chronicling the Warriors' last season in Oakland. It's time for three stories you should know, and we're going to stay with the Golden State Warriors for a bit. I'm joined by The Ringer's Katie Baker and by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Katie, you're up.
It was only a month ago that Kevin Durant was scoring 50 points to lift the Warriors over the Clippers in six games in the first round of the playoffs and reminding everyone why he was the NBA final MVP in back-to-back seasons. Between then and now, a calf strain that looks suspiciously like an Achilles injury took place, and suddenly the Warriors have not only been winning without Kevin Durant, they have seemed like their old selves again, fearless and fun. Of course, the pendulum has now swung the other way when, following Game 1, in which the Warriors lost to the Toronto Raptors, suddenly everyone is, you know, wondering if they can win without Kevin Durant at all. So once more, the pendulum has swung, and I'm sure it will do so many more times in the coming months.
I think that can an Achilles be considered a calf injury? The Achilles does connect the calf to the heel. And if the New York Jets and New York Giants play in New Jersey, I think in sports it could be considered. I would attribute 10 days off as one of the reasons why you would lose game one. But notwithstanding that, they're such a more joyous team without Kevin Durant. They're just a joy to watch. And of course, the insertion of some drama, could they possibly lose, makes sports not just more enjoyable, but it's the very reason that we watch sports.
Well, I have been enjoying recent headlines. All right, so here are a couple. Kevin Durant and the mirage of basketball heaven. Kevin Durant's inessential greatness. Inessential greatness. I love it. Kevin Durant is the NBA's best player, but the Warriors are way more fun without him. I mean, people seem to be in absolute agreement about this, right? He can be the best out there, and also this team can be more fun to watch without him. But Katie, I'm really with you. I'm thinking that now this narrative is going to change, because up until Thursday night, the idea that Golden State is better with Durant was theoretical. Like, everyone knew it was true. Everyone knew he was the best player, but the team was playing so well, it was really hard to see what they were missing without him. What changes as we move forward?
I agree with what Mike said, is that sometimes, especially with Durant, it almost seems like everyone is just lying in wait, trying to figure out what the next kind of micro controversy is. You know, and you wonder if they actually truly feel their takes, or if they're just going along with the rising and shifting tides of NBA discourse.
Mike, what do you have for us?
Well, the St. Louis Blues are in the Stanley Cup Finals, which has happened before, but they won a game this time, which hasn't. The history of this, and if you've been watching the finals, you'll probably note, because maybe the most famous goal in NHL Finals history was scored against the Blues. It was the series-clinching goal in 1970, Bobby Orr flying through the air. Hard to do on skates, I guess, a little bit easier knowing that the goal was in and you don't have to play any more hockey. But what happened was, St. Louis was one of the expansion teams, and the NHL decided to expand and double the league. And what they did was kind of insane in retrospect. They put all the expansion teams in one division. Then they would have the Stanley Cup Finals, and this was in the 1967-68 season. They had the Stanley Cup Finals pit the East against the West. The West were all expansion teams. Let me quote from Sports Illustrated at the time. All four of the East Division contenders are obviously better teams than any of the expansion clubs. Not one West team managed to finish the regular season with a 500 record. And guess what? The Blues made the finals for the first 3 years of their and all these other expansion teams' existence, and they got swept, mightily swept in the finals every time, and the NHL grand poobahs did not want to do a thing about it. Can you imagine if sports talk radio existed back then? What a horrible structure. So finally, I guess the Blues win a game.
First of all, if sports talk radio existed back then, they would all be pointing out that the famous Bobby Orr photo is so famous as a photo because the actual video is extremely underwhelming when you've only seen the photo. He basically scores a little tap in and then flies through the air afterwards. But that said, you know, when you see all the hemming and hawing that takes place today with the way the new divisions are and the wild card, people get upset about that enough. I can only imagine what it would be like. There's always going to be controversy in the National Hockey League.
But this isn't just controversy. It feels like we've gone back and rewritten history, right? Because when I moved to Boston in the 90s, I saw that photo like everywhere. And I had assumed that this must have been like one of those victory snatched from the jaws of defeat moments that, like, the Bruins would not have won that Stanley Cup if not for the amazing goal and Bobby Orr flying through the air. And, like, none of that is true. Like, the Bruins, absolutely, they might have lost that game, but they were absolutely going on to win the series. And I wonder if the other teams that absolutely trounced the Blues during those years have similarly rewritten their histories.
Well, the Montreal Canadiens didn't have to because they just win all the time, or they did back then. There was another Sports Illustrated article which depicted the Canadiens as attending a harness race, having some beers in the afternoon, and that Sunday going out and killing the St. Louis Blues, the best team in the West.
All right. Well, when my husband and I go to baseball games, we go for the sunshine and the beer and, yes, even a little bit of baseball. We do not go to see this.
Oh, look out, people.
Oh, a fan got nailed. And oh, it was a young fan. I'm sick to my stomach right now. Yeah. Albert Almora Jr. is down on one knee and sobbing.
That's from Wednesday night when a four-year-old girl was struck by a foul ball at an Astros game. At last report, she's expected to be fine. But just last August, a 79-year-old woman died after getting hit in the head at Dodger Stadium. That was after Major League Baseball required teams to extend protective netting to the end of the dugouts. In Japan, protective netting goes from foul pole to foul pole. And if you want to sit in a special section without netting, you pay extra and you're issued a helmet and a glove. This is the thing I can't figure out. Why has Major League Baseball been so resistant to extending the netting? Is baseball really so worried that their game is so very boring that without the excitement of scrambling for foul balls, no one will come to the park?
I do think that teams in general are very nervous about, you know, making the in-game experience be lucrative enough to get fans into the park. And, you know, and like you said, I've enjoyed sitting in foul ball territory myself and feeling like I could at any moment go crazy and streak the field or something. But you listen to that clip and no one should be describing a player sobbing as a child is carried away in real time. I was looking at the comments on a New York Times piece about what happened, and you do see a lot of people saying, pay more attention. Get off your phones. Don't sit there. Snowflakes, take some responsibility. So I think that societal attitude might be part of it. But it's also, you know, baseball doesn't need to be beholden to that type of fan. And they can rise above it and set their own agenda.
I think that calling out fans for not paying attention is unfair. Mm-hmm. The appeal of baseball rests in the fact that you needn't pay attention for much of the time. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I mean, you're hailing the vendor to get those. And that's right there in the most iconic song associated with the game. Obviously, it's short-sighted financial issue. And also, obviously, this is much of human nature. Stop signs aren't erected usually until a crash or near crash occurs. That said, I do think that in society there was a greater assumption of risk. Things have gotten so much safer, it shouldn't be the case that paying a lot of money for a good seat at the ballpark is a more dangerous thing than, you know, taking your car and riding to the ballpark itself. So the incentive is there to try to do everything not to let this happen again.
Yeah. I've got to admit, I have a bias toward this, which has come from interviewing parents of a small child who was hit in the head from a baseball. And they were watching. They were paying attention. They did everything they could to keep this from happening to their child. And so it's really hard after having one of those conversations to then just say, oh, well, there's some fans who don't like it, or I totally don't believe the money issue because the Red Sox put in, you know, they recently extended the netting to the end of the dugout, and the Red Sox used that as an excuse to put in a whole new section of seats. So I really think you can find ways to recoup the costs. It's not about that. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Katie Baker and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Timothy Simons played Jonah Ryan on HBO's Veep. On a show known for its insults, has anybody gotten more of them than Jonah?
If the cruelty registered, our show would be an hour and 15 minutes long, because every scene would be like, excuse me, you can't speak to me that way.
This week on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
I'm Karen Given. They met in secret, away from their white coaches and teammates.
We used to meet at midnight. We could have met earlier. But we used to meet at midnight to lay out our thoughts and plans, just like the slaves.
Dana Horrell was one of nine college football players the international media would incorrectly call the Syracuse Eight.
It was the late 1960s, after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and Bobby Kennedy.
That's Only a Game's Shira Springer.
Dana and his black teammates didn't just see racial injustice, they lived it, and they wanted to do something about it.
The Syracuse Eight held some of their secret meetings on campus, but whenever they were hungry, they went to Ben's Kitchen. They were all working-class kids from inner cities, and they talked about their plans over plates of barbecue chicken, collard greens, and cornbread among the prostitutes and hustlers and the nightly craps game.
For the people of color in the city, that was the place, that was the joint.
That's Abdullah Alif Muhammad. Back then, he was known as Al Newton.
When all the other places closed, that's the place where you would go to get something to eat.
And trust me, there were no spies or infiltrators there.
At the time, Syracuse was a nationally prominent football program. Dana and his teammates had inherited the proud legacy of Jim Brown, one of the greatest football players of all time, and Ernie Davis.
Ernie Davis of Syracuse.
In 1961, Davis became the first African-American to win the Heisman Trophy.
The 21-year-old whiz kid is as hard to stop as a 10-ton truck. Watch that number 44.
Throughout the 1960s, Syracuse rode a wave of success, appearing in bowl games and filling the rosters of NFL teams. But the Syracuse Eight were considering something that would put their NFL careers in jeopardy, a boycott.
And let's be clear about this. They all wanted to play. None of them had signed their letters of intent to Syracuse, expecting to sit out. But there was a lot about their Syracuse experience they didn't expect.
It was a short ride from the airport to the university, but that's all it took to educate running back Greg Allen about the realities of being a black football player at Syracuse. Greg was driven to campus by the coach who recruited him.
We get in the car, and we begin, you know, the small talk. You know, Greg, gee, I'm glad you're here. We want you to have a good time while you're at Syracuse. We want you to get a good education. We want you to grow. We want you to have a great career as a football player. But the one thing we're going to ask you to do is not date any white girls while you're here. It was a little bit of a shock for me because I knew that I had traveled north of the Mason-Dixon line, not below it.
And there was more. Alif was a proud alum of Ringe Technical School with a near-perfect math SAT score. He wanted to be an engineer, but...
They wouldn't allow me to take a calculus course, a math course, because it was during football practice. And the only option was to take a calculus honors class. And the assumption was, oh, you're a football player. What are you doing over here? And I felt kind of insulted. And it was kind of like, you know, they wanted me to take like general reading classes and general education classes. And it was like, wait a minute. No. I didn't come here for that.
Greg Allen was told he couldn't be a biology major because he wouldn't have time for labs. But he says that policy didn't apply to white players. So the Syracuse 8 drafted a petition asking the administration to give black and white players the same access to tutors and academic advisors.
But most of the requests the group hashed out at Ben's Kitchen would benefit both the black and white players. Take the team doctor.
Our medical doctor for our football team was a gynecologist by training.
Alif says the recommendation for every injury was ice and rest. More than that, Greg says the doctor was hesitant to touch black bodies.
You know, there were two sets of latex gloves, and anything that could be avoided was avoided. So, yeah, it's just you're at a major university, and at the time, one of the best football programs in the country, and you don't think enough of your players to get them expert medical care.
The next item on the list had to do with playing time. The Big Southern schools still weren't integrated. They wouldn't play against teams with black players. And Dana Harrell says north of the Cotton Curtain, schools followed unofficial rules about how many black players could be on the field at the same time, even at home games.
You could have three outstanding halfbacks, but you wouldn't play them all together because you didn't want the big money boosters. That's what I call them. The big money boosters to accuse the program of going black.
It's dehumanizing. My talents, my own personal desires and wishes and goals and dreams take a back seat to this thing called race or racism.
The players felt if the team had a black assistant coach, many of these issues would go away. But by the spring of 1970, they'd been asking their coaches to hire a black assistant for a year. It hadn't happened.
Meanwhile, Greg Allen attended a meeting where a group of students and university leaders discussed starting a black studies program at Syracuse. A couple days later, he got a call to meet with head football coach Ben Schwartzwalder.
So I walked into the coach's office and I sat down. And he peered at me over his glasses, and he looked at me, and he said, what's this I hear about you and this black crap?
Greg started to explain his position, but he says the coach really wasn't listening.
So he looked me in the eye, and he said, well, then you have a decision to make. You can't be black and be a football player. Of course, I was a little taken back. I said, well, coach, you know, I'm going to be black all my life. I'm only going to be a football player for a short period of time, but I don't see how one would interfere with the other.
These were the issues Alif and Dana and Greg and the other black players talked about when they met at Ben's Kitchen. By the way, Greg liked it there, too.
Great soul food, so yeah, it was a good place.
For Greg and his teammates, Syracuse University was also a good place. There was no sense in transferring. They felt no other school would have been better or worse, so
we decided to stay and fight for the soul of this great university.
As spring approached, the players decided to appeal to the coach one more time. If they didn't see substantial efforts to address their grievances, they'd walk out of spring practice. Not a game or an alumni event, nothing that would put the program at risk, just spring practice.
When we found out that, you know, the coach really wasn't going to meet our requests, we didn't show up for practice the next day. We knew if we had someone leak it to the press that we would get the attention that we thought we deserved.
The players got that attention, but they soon discovered that they weren't in control of the narrative. The media seized on one of their requests in particular, that the school hire a black assistant coach. The other demands, the ones that would benefit everyone, they were forgotten.
Greg says the papers labeled the Syracuse 8 as black dissidents or black militants or sometimes just the blacks.
We were never asked any questions or the media never contacted us to get any of our opinions. No one was really interested in our perspective.
The nine members of the Syracuse 8 were suspended from the team, and some of their white teammates threatened to boycott if the black players were allowed back. Soon, Dana says, the chancellor's office was flooded with letters from alumni.
We want them off the team. We want their scholarships revoked. Some of them wanted us out of Syracuse University. They called us everything except a child of God, by the way. And they would put under their signature how much they contribute every year. Some of the fans threatened to boycott the games if we were ever allowed to come back. Well, we heard that before.
Yeah, he's talking about Colin Kaepernick.
And like Colin Kaepernick, the Syracuse Eight had a lot to lose. Each was the first member of his family to go to college, and each was now risking his scholarship to stand up for what he believed in. Once the story hit the papers, Dana Harrell got a call from his father.
Well, the conversation went like this. I went on like a 19, 20-year-old young person would do about, you know, because everything's so clear when you're 19 and 20 years old, about what was right and what was wrong and what I felt I had to do. And he let me get it all out. And he said to me, Dana, when you're 40 years old and have a family and a mortgage and things you want to do for them, you're going to need that college degree. Click.
The players went home for the summer, not knowing what would come of their protest. Would they be allowed back on the team? Would they lose their scholarships?
Over the summer, Jim Brown stepped in to help, acting as an intermediary between the players and Coach Schwarzwalder. It didn't work. But on orders from the chancellor, Schwarzwalder did try to find a black assistant coach. Jake Gaither, the head coach at Florida A&M, told Elif,
"You guys don't need a coach. You need a Martin Luther King. I mean, who do you think is going to step into that?" There's a lot of coaches that turned that job down. They knew the deal, and they didn't want to step into that.
When Elif returned to Syracuse in the fall, a black assistant coach had been hired, but
he was not on the program, listed as a coach. I remember going to a meeting, and the coaches were meeting, and the blackboard with X's and O's, and he's sitting in the back of the room with his head down on the desk like he was sleeping. You talk about something that was hurtful. I mean, it was like, wait a minute. I mean, I sacrificed a career. I felt deeply, deeply hurt.
The Syracuse Eight decided to continue their boycott. They sat out the whole season, and the chancellor and a group of faculty members made their own stand. They said,
"These guys will keep their scholarship. You will not mess with their education. All right? They will graduate."
And they did.
I turned that type A focus from sports to academics, and it worked. And it worked. But you sit there squirming on Sunday afternoon watching guys you played with and against. And, you know, they're still having fun. And it takes a while to get it out of your system.
Of the nine, eight graduated from Syracuse University. Four went on to earn master's degrees. Dana Harrell went to law school. Another player completed the coursework for a PhD, but never finished his dissertation.
With the faculty and the chancellor on their side, the Syracuse Eight started seeing changes at the school. But while their academic careers took off, their football careers stalled. After his sophomore season, Greg Allen was contacted by scouts from every NFL team. Then came the boycott. Greg played his senior year at Syracuse, but he didn't hear from a single NFL scout. He ended up in Canada, playing for the CFL. And that's when he discovered how far the influence of the NFL reached.
One day I was asked to come into the coach's office, and I went to see the coach. And he says, "Greg, we're going to have to let you go." And I said, "Let me go? What are you talking about, coach? I'm doing well here, you know. You said I was the best athlete in camp." He said, "Yeah, but you have a little bit too much baggage for us."
Even in that moment, did you have a twinge of regret?
No, it was pure anger. I was angry that I had to go through this only because I decided that institutional racism had no place at Syracuse University or anyplace else in this world.
The nine members of the Syracuse Eight moved on with their lives. They raised their families and launched successful careers. Dana Harrell moved to the Boston area, where he coached a Pop Warner football team. Elif Muhammad's youngest son was one of his players.
We weren't talking about the Syracuse Eight stuff. It was 36 years ago. Our kids didn't even know anything about it. Nothing.
But back in Syracuse, people had started talking about the events of 1970. Alumni and some of the Syracuse Eight's white teammates lobbied the university to make a formal apology.
And then in 2006, the Syracuse Eight were invited back to receive the Chancellor's Medal, the university's highest honor, and their Letterman's jackets, a few sizes larger than they would have been in 1970.
They played Louisville, and it was at halftime. They had us come down.
They had us in the tunnel, and they wanted us, when they called our names, for us to run out of the tunnel like we did in our playing days. And we looked at them like they were crazy. We don't have two good knees between us. But the satisfaction was immeasurable.
And we're nothing but smiles and old men welling up in tears. I almost don't have the words to describe it. It was a cleansing, a lifting of this baggage that I've been carrying around for years, to have someone finally acknowledge that we didn't do this, you know, despite the university or hurt the university. We're trying to make, you know, the university and this world just a better place.
It took 36 years for the Syracuse Eight to meet again on that football field instead of at Ben's Kitchen. 36 years for Syracuse to apologize and recognize the players were on the right side of history. 36 years.
So we asked Dana Harrell, how long before Colin Kaepernick's critics see him in a different light? Will someone someday ask him to run out on a football field in front of a cheering crowd?
I'm going to answer that first with a quote. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Dr. King gave that answer when he was asked how long did he think it would take for African Americans to get full rights here in America. And, you know, he said, how long?
Not long, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
How long? Not long. So that's my answer.
Only a Game's Shira Springer joined me in reporting that piece. We first aired it in November of 2017. The nine members of the Syracuse Eight are Dana Harrell, Greg Allen, Alif Muhammad, John Loban, Ronald Womack, Clarence McGill, Richard Bowles, John Godbolt, and Dwayne Walker. Their stories are told in the book Leveling the Playing Field, The Story of the Syracuse Eight. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Leanne Harris finished her first marathon in 2005.
Crossing that finish line was like being God, being on top of the world and looking down at everything else. My first thought was, okay, when's the next one?
Training for that next one was going to be a bit tougher than Leanne could have predicted. That story's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I mark it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years?
Oh, I still think about it every time I see his face.
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the 1999 Women's World Cup team wasn't just successful on the field. We look back at their off-the-field fight for gender equity. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Fans started lining up before 4 a.m. to get into Jurassic Park on Thursday. That's 11 hours before the gates would even open. I mean, what's the big deal? It was a really good movie, but it came out 26 years ago.
No, people wanted to watch the Toronto Raptors on their big screen. So life is good.
Well, as you say, Jurassic Park is an outdoor viewing area for Toronto Raptors games. Am I the only one who's really enjoying how much Toronto is getting into this championship run?
Oh, no. Toronto's a great city. I'm really sorry that the Maple Leafs didn't do something this year, because to have both of those teams in the playoffs would be Canadian nirvana.
In recent years, the NHL has gone to great lengths to create a style of play that's faster, more skilled, and less violent. But it seems to me that the current Stanley Cup Finals between the St. Louis Blues and Boston Bruins are delaying that transformation. Do you agree?
Yeah, it's a really old-fashioned hockey, especially the second game in which the Blues managed to beat the Bruins in Boston. Tory Krug absolutely leveled St. Louis's Robert Thomas and probably won't be punished for it. The reason he won't be punished is because nobody's really sure what charging is anymore.
Longtime major leaguer Bill Buckner died on Monday at the age of 69. Buckner is best remembered for one play on October 25th, 1986, when the ball went through his legs and the Red Sox lost Game 6 of the World Series to the Mets. But he really deserves to be remembered for much more than that, doesn't he?
Sure, he was a very good baseball player. He never struck out three times in a game, which I think is really, you know, is just remarkable given the way people swing so freely. Blaming Bill Buckner takes the Red Sox manager at the time, John McNamara, off the hook, which is really, really the wrong thing to do because it was McNamara's bungling in Game 6 and 7 that cost the Red Sox that World Championship.
This week, I've heard a lot of Red Sox fans focusing on the moment in 2008 after the team had won two World Series when Buckner came back to Fenway Park and all was forgiven. And it was a really nice moment. But are we letting ourselves off the hook for our behavior after the 86 series?
I think a little bit, yeah. I think it went on a little bit too long. I mean, it was understandable. He was the unfortunate face of one of the great collapses of all time. But the ovation he got was extremely delayed.
Bart Starr has died at the age of 85. Starr was the quarterback who, along with Coach Vince Lombardi, led the Green Bay Packers to five championships in the 1960s. How will you remember Starr?
Just as the efficient but largely faceless captain of the ship. His statistics are remarkable. He's probably the most underrated quarterback in NFL history because Vince Lombardi was such a gigantic figure. But if you look at Bart Starr's career numbers, they're really, really good. And people don't seem to remember that.
Yeah, I had not realized until now that Starr was a 17th round draft pick in 1956.
Even less well thought of than Tom Brady was.
By one position.
Yeah.
There have been at least 11 deaths on Everest this year, and overcrowding was definitely a factor. And if this sounds familiar, that's because there were 11 deaths on Everest in 2012 when the climbing routes were similarly overcrowded. What's going on?
Too many people are trying to climb Mount Everest, and I blame the movie and rise of the phrase bucket list for this. I am astonished by the photo of the line of people waiting to summit. The top of Mount Everest is not supposed to look like Best Buy on the day after Thanksgiving. It's simply not right.
Every time there's a particularly deadly season on Everest, people say all the right things about considering changes and regulations, and it just never seems to happen. What is it going to take?
Well, if this doesn't do it, nothing will. People are dying like partridges up there. It's not supposed to be something you check off along with, you know, windsurfing in Cabo San Lucas and you know, skateboarding in the Amazon or whatever.
A champion was crowned in the Scripps Spelling Bee on Thursday night, or maybe I should say champions, right?
Yeah, good for them. No playoffs, no penalty shots, nothing. Eight people are the best, eight people win.
Well, that's what happens when you run out of words.
Well, yeah,
right?
apparently they ran out of English words to get these guys. I mean, I would have gone back to the real simple ones because I'm totally convinced that some of these kids are so wired that if you ask them to spell cat, they'll blow it. Sports!
And finally, Charlie, Browns wide receiver Odell Beckham Jr. wants folks to know that he's in Cleveland to stay, or at least for a while. So how's he showing his loyalty towards his new team?
Well, first of all, he has a Rolls Royce, but he's painted it a god-awful orange to celebrate being a Brown. And he's got this hood ornament, which depicts his famous over-the-back-of-the-head one-handed catch. But the thing that really fascinates me is that it's a retractable hood ornament because apparently people go around and steal Rolls-Royce hood ornaments. So he's got one that goes down into the hood when his car is parked.
Charlie Pierce joins us on Only a Game each week at this time. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Leanne Harris started running when she was in her late 40s. She set a goal of completing 7 marathons. That goal became a lot more difficult when she lost first her job, then her apartment, and ended up in a homeless shelter in downtown Seattle. Reporter Eilish O'Neill has the story.
Leanne Harris says she's always been an anxious person. She got divorced when she was in her early 30s, and that made things worse.
My sense of self and worth was very, very, very damaged.
When she was in her late 40s, she read that daily exercise could help. So she started walking.
Either before work or after work, I would go out and I would just walk around the block and I would time it. I was doing 30 minutes a day just walking. That was it.
On one of those days, her teenage daughter came along and they walked around a high school track together.
She said, "I dare you to run around the track." And I said, "Yeah, right." And she said, "Seriously, run around it. See if you can do it." "All right, I'll try." So I started jogging, huffing and puffing, but I did make it around the loop. After that, I got it in my head to start jogging a little bit here and there. What running did for me was give me self-confidence and a much higher sense of worth and value. So I got over feeling like I wasn't good enough as a woman.
By late 2003, about a year after she started running, Leanne could run for almost an hour without stopping.
I was wanting to do longer than that. I thought, well, you know, I don't know what's involved with doing a marathon, but I can check into it. I had not done a 5K. I had not done a 10K. I don't think it had registered with me that I should start out with something smaller, honestly. It just never occurred to me.
Leanne signed up for the 2004 Maui Marathon. After training through Seattle's mild summer, she headed to Hawaii in the early fall. The day of her race, temperatures were in the 80s, with humidity over 60%.
I started getting close to the mile marker 18. My legs would no longer hold me up. I was holding on to the milepost, and I literally started to faint.
Someone called 911 and an ambulance picked her up and brought her to a hospital to be treated for dehydration and heat stroke. But she says, if anything, that experience made her more determined to finish a marathon.
When I set my mind on something, I dig in my heels and I don't quit until I've done it.
So Leanne trained for and ran Seattle's Seafair Marathon the following summer.
Crossing that finish line was like being God, being on top of the world and looking down at everything else. My first thought was, okay, when's the next one?
Leanne set a goal of running 7 marathons. She says she picked that number because Lance Armstrong had won the Tour de France 7 times. But things weren't going well in her life. She was living in an apartment, but she only made $1,000 a month working part-time. She couldn't pay the rent. She ended up moving into a rooming house. Leanne says she got a new job canvassing for the Sierra Club, but she lost that. She couldn't find another job. This was 2005, and the economy was starting to slow down. No one was hiring. Leanne's savings were rapidly disappearing. And then the city of Seattle found that the rooming house where she was living wasn't up to code. Everyone was evicted. Leanne had no job and almost no money. She ended up in a shelter in downtown Seattle.
It was in a basement, like a huge warehouse basement, and there were 40 women crammed in, and there was no fresh air, there were no windows, the ceiling was black. They dimmed the lights at night, they did not turn them out, and the attendants were required to walk through. I'm a very light sleeper. I couldn't sleep for 5 nights straight when I first got in there.
Leanne says the hardest part was her lack of control.
As an independent woman who'd been taking care of 2 kids all her life, that was a real insult to me, not being allowed to make my own decisions about when to get up, when to go to bed, what I could eat, what I couldn't eat. You really have to give up a lot of your independence to be part of the shelter system.
Through it all, Leanne kept running.
The running made me feel in control. Again, it made me feel reconnected to the real me. The people that I passed were normal, everyday, average people. And if I conversed with them, it was as an everyday, average, normal human being who they had no idea what circumstance I was in. It helped me to connect with society in a healthy way.
It wasn't easy to keep up her training. For For one thing, she didn't have enough food. She was living on food stamps, about $5 a day, and the food offered in the shelter made her sick.
And so I would try to find some bread or something like that to eat. I often went to bed hungry, lost a very great deal of weight.
Leanne would wake up before anyone else in the shelter and put everything she'd need for the day in her backpack. Then she'd take the bus to wherever she wanted to run that day, hide her backpack, and run. That's how it worked until one day when she went to Seattle's Queen Anne neighborhood for a run.
I looked around and didn't see any real bushes that I could hide the pack behind, so I set it just on the ground in a flower bed. I had done that before, and it had been okay. This particular time, I came back and the backpack was gone.
A week later, someone at the hygiene center, a place where homeless people can do their laundry and take a shower, gave Leanne a new backpack. After that, she started leaving her backpack at the Seattle Running Company, a running store not too far from her shelter.
I just said, you know, I don't have a car. I'm here to run. Can I leave my backpack here?
Dropping by the Seattle Running Company three times a week gave Leanne something else, too, a running community.
Boy, those were the days I really enjoyed listening to them talk. It's very, very, very motivating because they share not just the accomplishment, but what they have suffered in the doing of it. And it helps you, okay, he did that, I can do this. And that was one of the reasons why I was so focused on the seven marathons and continuing with the running is because I was part of that mindset too, where you set a goal and you don't give up.
So Leanne decided not to wait till she had a job and a home to run another marathon. In May 2006, she packed some blankets in her backpack and rode the Greyhound bus down to Olympia, about an hour south of Seattle, the night before the Capital City Marathon.
Slept on the steps of one of the government buildings and got up in the morning and changed and stored all my gear with under the table. And I said, I've got a lot of stuff here. Is this going to be okay? And they said, yeah, it's going to be okay.
When Leanne crossed the finish line that day, in 5 hours and 2 minutes, she said to herself,
okay, I'm going to be okay for a while now, you know? And that really helped a lot.
Did you feel like you were going to be okay because you had done something powerful and strong?
Very much so, very much so.
Leanne went on to run two more marathons while homeless. She says she took the feeling that finishing those races gave her and she used it to get back on her feet in another way.
Because I had set the goals that I did and was meeting them, that perhaps I could finish a two-year degree. And it was when I was at Highland Community College finishing my two-year degree that I decided to see if I could go for a four-year degree.
Leanne transferred to Central Washington University, which is about 100 miles east of Seattle in the city of Ellensburg. She got a student loan so she could move out of the shelter into a dorm, and then eventually into her own apartment. She finished college with a degree in music and a minor in exercise science. She's still living in Ellensburg, not far from where she went to college in low-income housing. She can't run these days because of arthritis in her hips. She misses it.
There's something about being in the fresh air, the pounding on the pavement, the repetition of the pavement, the exertion that your body is going through. It makes you feel better.
Before she had to give up the sport, Leanne Harris ran the 2010 Seattle Marathon. It was her seventh marathon finish.
That's reporter Eilish O'Neill. We first learned about Leanne's story in a piece in the Seattle Times. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.